This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
A new report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, released last week says that 12 of India's cities, including Mumbai, Chennai, Kochi, and Mangalore, could go 3 feet underwater by the end of the century. But how real is this possibility? I mean, the end of the century is pretty far away, right? When I dug deeper, I found out that this isn't really a distant possibility that only our children or grandchildren might have to face. In this episode, I'll tell you why a Mumbai or a Chennai turning into a version of the fabled underwater city of Atlantis might be closer than we think. But don't worry, there are ways to stop this from happening. I'm Anjali Venugopalan, and you're listening to The Morning Brief. We know that rising emissions in the atmosphere are causing global temperatures to rise, and that's melting sea ice and glaciers. And this adds volumes of water to the sea. The IPCC report credits this as a major factor in increasing sea levels. I spoke to Roxy Matthew Cole, one of the lead authors of the IPCC reports. By the way, the IPCC report was put together by scientists from 195 nations. Now, Roxy is a climate scientist with the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology, and he says that melting sea ice is only one part of the story.
So the ice is melting at a faster rate. And we know that here also we have glaciers over the Himalayas and over other mountains, right? So that ice is also melting. So all this adds volumes of water to the sea, and the sea level is rising. But there is also one more reason on why sea level is rising. And that's called thermal expansion of water. So these oceans are absorbing the heat as well. In fact, more than 93% of the heat from global warming is absorbed by the ocean. It's not by the land, not by the atmosphere, or by the ice. And that is causing the water to expand. And if you look at regions like Indian Ocean, it's already tropical warm waters, right? In fact, in this IPCC report, what we see is that Indian Ocean is the fastest warming ocean compared to all other ocean basins. And there is one more factor.
Okay.
That is the changes in the land elevation. So some regions, like the coastal region north of Bay of Bengal and all, Bangladesh coast, there the land is sinking slowly. So the water level is relatively increasing.
When Roxy told me about melting ice, expanding water, and sinking land, it sounded like the flood myths that exist across world cultures. The Hindus believe that the fabled city of Dwarka drowned at the end of the Dwapara Yuga when the god Krishna died. In that story, the city slowly sunk underwater until the sea engulfed it. But what if your city went suddenly underwater for a few hours or days? Roxy tells me that this is becoming more likely thanks to something called compound events.
We have something called compound events where multiple extremes overlap. So, for example, we see cyclones occurring along the coast of India, right? And when you have a cyclone, it pushes a lot of seawater along the coast. We call it storm surge. The average height of these waves can be about 5 meters or above. So that pushes a lot of water onto the coastal region. And along with that, the same cyclone can bring in a lot of rain also over the same coastal region. So now you've got two elements of climate that can flood the coastal region. And along with that, we know that the sea level is rising year by year. So that raises the level of this flooding every year, every decade. So when these kind of events, like when floods occur due to cyclones or heavy rains, those floods could be prolonged and spread over a large area, maybe kilometers inland. Like when Cyclone Yaas happened, we saw something like this happening. Several storm surge and rainwater and the sea level working together. I mean, we thought the East Coast was always resilient to cyclones and all, but we saw the water going inland several kilometers.
The cyclone Yaas that Roxy mentioned crashed through the east coast of India as well as Bangladesh in May this year. Well over a million people in the states of Odisha and West Bengal were displaced. The state government of West Bengal said that about 4,500 villages were affected by the cyclone. That's well over 10% of the total number of villages in West Bengal. Vast tracts of farmlands were destroyed as saline water intruded into them.
At least two people have died as Cyclone Yaas made landfall today. Predicted first to be a very severe cyclonic storm, the cyclone is now weakening after large-scale damage in several parts of coastal West Bengal and Odisha.
Port in Odisha, but right now we are at East Midnapore's Digha, and one cannot differentiate between which is the sea and which is the beach line here. There are barricades, there is a railing, but one may find it difficult to differentiate because the sea has been swelling. As we inch closer to the time of the landfall, you can see extremely, extremely rough sea conditions.
The one silver lining was that the loss of life was minimal. But life under the shadow of an impending cyclone is not an easy one.
My parents, who are both from Orissa, have said time and again that because they lived in rural regions and every few years they experienced a cyclone, so they were always ready to move. Every monsoon season came with the sort of anxiety that we might have to move, so they have to leave and then come back and then build the houses again. So the houses were also made with materials like that, which are actually quite climate friendly and sustainable, but they had to be there for a reason. So everybody dreamed of having a pakka house, but they did not. And that is the story of much of Orissa and Andhra Pradesh, as you said.
That was my colleague Shashwat Mohanty. Shashwat is the one who tells us whether or not to bring our umbrellas to work on any particular day. I mean, he's ET's climate and weather correspondent. Shashwat told me how the famed Indian monsoons are changing and how this could affect India's economy.
So Anjali, the southwest monsoon supports roughly about two-thirds of the Indian population, either directly or indirectly, mostly through the agricultural sector. We've been seeing effects of climate change slowly but steadily, and these effects have risen over, you know, especially the last 10 years. So monsoon used to be a four-month event. It starts in June and then ends in September. Now, because of climate change, we've seen that the monsoon exits India only by October 2nd or 3rd week now in some parts. So the monsoon season has been delayed. It's also led to changes in sowing patterns. We have these set dates based on the old normal dates, but now the sowing has been delayed and consequently the harvest is delayed. And we don't know yet in the long term how it will react, because if the rains are delayed, farmers can't keep their crops sown in for too long, right? They'll have to then again remove it and then sow fresh seeds. Agriculture then leads to an uptick in rural sentiment. So if it's a good harvest, the rural sentiment is really high. People make more purchases. So one direct correlation is the auto industry. We see a huge uptick in the sales of tractors and two-wheelers. These go up when it's a good monsoon, it's a good crop, it's a good harvest. We see people in the rural areas buying mobile phones and gold. So that is a huge effect of the monsoon on the Indian economy.
How will this affect lives and livelihoods?
Anjali, we're already seeing an impact this very year in 2021. As you and I record this podcast, we are currently in the midst of the second break in the monsoon season. The first break was a three-week period that started on June 21st, which led to inadequate rainfall that persisted till July 10th. So a four-month period, and we've already had roughly about 28 to 30 days of inadequate rain. Now, as of recording right now, we are on the 14th consecutive day of again inadequate rain. So it's kind of like our COVID waves, where the economy just starts to recover and then again another wave strikes. So the same way, monsoon breaks are leading to a really, really low acreage of kharif crops. Consequently, our harvest is going to be really poor, which might lead to inflation. So people like you and I will be spending by the end of the year more at our sabzi mandis. But this also puts very less money in the hands of the farmers, which can again lead to very low consumptions. Apart from this, you know, the rising number of cyclones, the rising number of extreme weather events, as Roxy already put it, is going to lead to a lot of crop damage. So again, Maharashtra, we saw widespread damages last month, which is the other end of the spectrum from droughts, where standing crops were completely destroyed because of flooding. So, you know, farmers can't seem to find a way out of here. Either you don't get any rainfall, and when it rains, it floods.
Floods have been both a boon and bane for cultures throughout history. The Harappa civilization is said to have been wiped out due to frequent floods and seawater entering farmlands. In Mumbai, floods are an annual occurrence. The city is one of the largest in the world, with a population of 21 million expected to rise to 40 million by 2050. Roxy said it was like adding a Mumbai on top of Mumbai. Since the 2005 floods that devastated the city and led to hundreds of lives lost, the city hasn't had a major disaster like that. But now, the city is having dangerously close encounters with cyclones. A cyclone has lashed the city four times in the last 5 years. In 2017, it was Cyclone Okhi. In 2019, it was Vayu. In 2020, it was Nisarg. In 2021, it was Tote. This is because even as the Indian Ocean is warming faster than the world's oceans, the Arabian Sea in particular is bearing the brunt of the heat. And cyclones love warm waters.
These cyclones and heavy rains as well, they draw their source of energy and also the moisture from warm waters of the oceans below. So you will only see cyclones forming over the warm tropical oceans generally. So we see our research using cyclone data during the past four decades shows that there is a 50% increase in the number of cyclones in the Arabian Sea. And it's not just the number of cyclones, their intensity is increasing. So their intensity is increasing by 20% to 40%. And the duration of these cyclones also, the duration they are spending over the ocean, sucking up this energy and moisture, that has increased by 80%.
So how far away are we really, you know, till the eye of a cyclone, you know, makes landfall directly in Bombay?
The more cyclones that form over the Arabian Sea, the chances of them making landfall over the West Coast also increase. So we cannot tell for certain where it will hit. And we also do not have an understanding if cyclone tracks are changing in the Arabian Sea. So the only thing we can say right now is there are more cyclones forming and they are much more intense. They are spending more time, like Cyclone Tote we saw. It spent a very long time in the ocean and it in fact went very close to all the West Coast states and Union Territories, starting from Lakshadweep. It then went very close to Kerala, Karnataka, Goa, Maharashtra, and then had landfall over Gujarat. And not only that, usually cyclones, after making landfall, they dissipate, they die off quickly because they do not have the moisture and the heat from the ocean anymore. And also the friction of the land prevents them from evolving further. Cyclone Tote had absorbed that much energy that it maintained that cyclone status for more than a day after landfall. So these kind of events are increasing. And so we need to be prepared over the West Coast of India.
Extreme events like cyclones are no longer a distant possibility for cities. But there's one more thing that's raising the risk of a Mumbai or a Chennai or even a small town like Chiplun or Kolhapur in Maharashtra flooding. It's what we're doing to our cities and its rivers. Construction along riverbanks and marshy areas are squeezing out rivers. But when the river and its water have no place to go, they wreak havoc. The devastating 2005 floods of Maharashtra were blamed on the water overflowing from the Mithi River having no place to go. It was the same with the 2015 Chennai floods. The landslides during the recent Maharashtra floods too have been linked to construction activities.
Well, much of it is still uninvestigated, but we know that landslides happen very frequently because these Western Ghats are generally becoming vulnerable. Because if you don't have the forest cover to hold the soil and the water below, and if you have construction or other kind of human interventions, landslides occur. Because when heavy rains fall on the soil, it gets saturated very fast, and all the boulders and rock and mud and everything, water flows down.
But what was it like to actually live through the recent Maharashtra floods? I spoke to Shevanti Kumar, who works as a domestic help in Kolhapur. Here's what she had to say.
नुकसान झालं बरंच नुकसान झालं 20 वर्षापासून आय एम कोल्हापुरात.
शेवंती सेड दॅट ऑन जुलाय 22 दिस इयर द फ्लड वॉटर्स रोज सो क्विकली दॅट शी कुड ओनली मॅनेज टू ग्रॅब अ फ्यू एसेन्शियल्स बिफोर फ्लीइंग.
भरतो धान्य ते वर्षाचं भरतो.
Many of her kitchen utensils were washed away. Food grains, furniture and vehicle too were damaged. And although she received an emergency kit from the government, it wasn't enough to cover her losses. It's not just India. This year, extreme weather took center stage in many parts of the world.
Dozens of people in the Vancouver area of Western Canada have died in an unprecedented heat wave.
With yet more intense heat in the US this week, forest fires in many western states can be seen from space.
The second largest fire now in California history. In one month, the Dixie Fire has covered more than 550,000 acres destroyed.
Some climate scientists say that it's a sign that the buffers in the Earth's climate control system are collapsing and the weather as we know it is suddenly beginning to fall apart.
So this was huge. Even climate scientists like me, for me, this was a shock. Well, we keep on warning about extreme heat and temperatures and all, but it suddenly took us by surprise. Yeah. Well, it is not unexpected, but it took us by surprise. And we saw actually 2 days back, Italy, city in Italy called Sicily, recorded, I think, around 49 degrees Celsius, which is, I'm not exact here, but about 48.8 or something. And these temperatures broke all-time European records. Yeah. So we are seeing unprecedented heat waves across. And as the temperatures rise, the chances of wildfires are also increasing. We see wildfires, I think even this year, central parts of India, including Madhya Pradesh and all, we saw wildfire spreading across central India. That was huge, actually. I saw in the map the spots detected by the satellites.
And this brings me back to the IPCC report that we talked about in the beginning. We've all known for decades that climate change is a threat. Then what makes this report different?
Well, the thing is, scientists are very careful in the language they choose. IPCC was formed in 1988. The first report came out in 1990. The most significant one came out in 2013, which was the fifth report, which definitively said temperature in the atmosphere will rise by 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial era levels by 2050. But even at that time, we weren't really sure what is the cause for global warming. This current report, which came out last week, uses the word unequivocal.
It is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean and the land. Almost all the observed warming from the late 1800s is human caused. That what's new in this report is that we now have a much more advanced understanding of the connections between the emissions we release and the rise in global surface temperature.
Climate change is a problem that is here now. Nobody's safe, and it's getting worse faster. We must treat climate change as an immediate threat, just as we must treat the connected crisis of nature and biodiversity loss and pollution and waste as immediate threats.
What is clear from this report is that unless there are immediate, strong, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius will be beyond reach. At 2 degrees of global warming, heat extremes would more often reach critical tolerance thresholds for agriculture and human health. At a global scale,
we can't undo the mistakes of the past, but this generation of political and business leaders, this generation of conscious citizens, can make things right. Climate change is here now, but we are also here now. And if we don't act, who will?
So they said that it is unequivocal that humans are behind this change. Prior to this, we weren't sure. There was 60% likelihood, 70% likelihood, but now we are sure that humans are the cause of it. and humans will only have to take steps to roll it back.
And these steps will have to be taken on a global scale.
It has gone beyond the scale of an individual or a nation now, because global emissions are at a very increasing at a fast rate. That the IPCC report shows that though we have made commitments for curbing emissions and mitigating and adaptation, these commitments themselves that we did through the Paris Agreement a few years back are not sufficient to keep the temperatures from rising further. So right now, the global average is about 1.1 degrees Celsius. Yeah, this is a global average. For each region, it will be different and the impacts will also be different. And this is going to definitely increase with the current emission scenario to 1.5 degrees Celsius in the current decade or the next decade, and 2 degrees Celsius by between 2040 to 2060. Yeah, so the climate is that curve is going uphill. Unlike the COVID curve, we are unable to flatten it any time sooner. So, and it's beyond, like I said, it's beyond the scale of an individual or a nation now. In fact, we need all the nations to work together.
While global action is important, what we do every day matters as well. Like taking public transport or using the AC less. Roxy also said that electing leaders aware of the threats of climate change and disasters is important.
I want climate change aware policymakers, whoever you elect, whether it's local elections or state elections or national elections, that should be based on whether climate change and your livelihoods and future is a priority. I will say start at a district level, call the experts who are, you can assess the risk at a district level, and any development or adaptation should be based on that risk.
In fact, Roxy also told me that India has made a lot of strides when it comes to managing disasters like cyclones and floods. This means that at least the death tolls have now come down to tens or hundreds sometimes, even though livelihoods are still badly affected. India has also made several strides in combating climate change. Even though the country's industries are still largely reliant on conventional polluting sources like coal, about 25% of our power generation capacity, which adds up to about 100 gigawatts, comes from renewable energy.
The government wants to increase this 100 gigawatt to 450 gigawatts by 2030. We also have the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which is commonly called as COP26 in November this year. Most of the world's major emitters are going to meet and discuss how to do this on the backdrop of the same IPCC report that we've just discussed. India is the third largest polluter in the world, the first being China and the second being USA. So Western nations, who did much of the damage during the industrial era, India feels that they should be doing more to cut their emissions. And while India is arguing that we need to realize our potential in terms of India's economic development, that, for better or for worse, goes hand in hand with emissions. So private players are still operating coal mines. But the government, for the first time since in the past maybe 3 or 4 decades, has not added coal as a power source this entire first quarter. So these are small encouraging signs that we are seeing. We are also on track to meet our Paris Agreement challenges that were handed to us. We will complete them well before time, which is 2030.
While India has displayed some commitment towards meeting its climate goals, countries like China and the United States, the biggest polluters in the world, are not that enthused. Still, the rise of Green Party is becoming mainstream in several countries in Europe, tells us that maybe climate change is becoming cool again. Our cities and towns are the birthplace of so many dreams and livelihoods. So many people, including my parents, migrated to a city from a village so that they could find better work and realize their dreams. But I, for one, really don't want to have to swim to work so that I can fulfill my dreams. I'm Anjali Venugopalan, and you've been listening to The Morning Brief. This episode was edited and coordinated by Shashwat Mohanty. The Morning Brief drops every Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. Send in your feedback at themorningbrief@timesgroup.com. If you like this episode, please share it on your social media handles. We'd really appreciate it. Goodbye and have a nice day. All clips used in this episode belong to their respective owners.